From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, the Washington Post digs through hundreds of pages of MSU emails and documents about accused sexual predator Dr. Larry Nassar and found missed warning signs.
In 2014, Michigan State investigated an allegation of assault against a doctor and found no wrongdoing, but they didn't let the folks at USA Gymnastics know about this.
She advised President Nixon. Now a leading economist has a message for President Trump about his proposed budget.
I would tell him that you don't make America great by undercutting a lot of things that historically have indeed made America great.
And Michigan's flying birdman from 80 years ago, a daredevil.
Clem held a world record for the longest dive before he pulled his chute. It was 18,500 feet.
But first, the news. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. More than 100 women and girls say they were abused by a Michigan State University sports doctor. Some liken this growing case against former MSU and USA Gymnastics Dr. Larry Nassar to the infamous Jerry Sandusky child sex case at Penn State.
In 2014, Michigan State investigated an allegation of assault against a doctor and found no wrongdoing, but they didn't let the folks at USA Gymnastics know about this.
Now, a Washington Post investigation into records and emails finds there were warning signs missed or ignored by Michigan State officials. That story later this hour. But first, we have seen an important development in the future of Flint and its drinking water. Mayor Karen Weaver says she wants the city to return to a long-term agreement with the Detroit-based Great Lakes Water Authority. And this reverses plans to connect Flint to the new competing Karenandi Water Authority, the KWA. Last Saturday, during Stateside's live show at the Flint Institute of Arts, I spoke with Senate Minority Leader and Flint's Democratic State Senator Jim Ananick. And here's our conversation. So what were your thoughts about Mayor Weaver's recommendation?
The recommendation is still pretty fresh, and a lot of folks are kind of digesting all the information, and I saw it at the same time the citizens did. I think one of the important things to note is that the citizens of Flint, I think I can speak for most of them, wanted to make sure that we had a long-term, reliable, healthy water source so that we have that answered. We have that now. There's some other questions I think still need to be answered. I think, you know, we still have, if not the highest, one of the highest rates for our water in the country, and that's something that needs to be addressed. That's some of the questions that I think a lot of people still have. Are we going to get rate relief? Is this the best deal that we can possibly get for our community? Are we going to have representation on this board that we will be the second biggest customer for? So we'll see if we can get those things answered, and if they're answered to a level that I'm satisfied with, then that's good. If it's not, then I'll take action at the state level.
Do you foresee a way that this arrangement will help get these water bills down?
It's definitely an issue that we have to resolve. One, it's just inhumane to expect people to have to choose between, you know, paying their water bill and paying other necessities. I mean, water is a right. Water is it's something that we have to have. And it's something that, you know, I live in Flint here with my family, and I know how expensive my water bills are, and it's just my wife and I and my son. So for families that are really struggling to make ends meet, we have to have this answered. So if this can help with that, great. If not, then we'll find other ways to keep addressing that issue.
At home, are you drinking the water?
No, I'm not going to lie to you. I mean, I was lied to like everyone else was. So I buy bottled water with fluoride in it for my son, and I use that primarily myself. I have a filter, but I have people look at me in the face at the highest levels of government and lie to me. So I feel like a lot of people in Flint do. There is still a lot of frustration, a lot of anger, a lot of fear. That is real and needs to be addressed because that kind of level of stress, our city is a stressful city, and it shouldn't be. We did nothing wrong. That needs to be acknowledged, and we need to move forward in fixing that.
In meantime, the legislature has been slow to respond with policy changes that could help prevent something like this from happening, that what happened in this community going elsewhere. What is holding things up in Lansing?
You know, that's a good question. I was asked that last week, and I didn't want to speculate, and I'm having conversations with leaders on both sides. It's a really troubling development, if you think about it. It never should have happened to people of Flint. I live in mm-hmm. Flint. My constituents shouldn't have gone through what happened. But if we don't learn from a terrible tragedy, really just shame on them and shame on anybody who doesn't get these changes, because this can happen. It will happen in other communities if we don't take the proper steps. And some of those steps are, obviously, the lead and copper rule has some flaws in it, without question. That's putting it nicely. Michigan should lead the way. We should have the best standards of anywhere in the country, and other people should follow us. And we should start that here in Flint. And to not change that, I've had the bill in place last session. I've had it in place now. We should make sure that every kid is tested on a regular basis to make sure that they're safe. We need to test daycare centers and schools. And I'm sorry, I don't really care what the cost is. Lead is a neurotoxin that has really damaging results to people. And if they're worried about costs, then, you know, that's just a ridiculous reason not to make changes.
When you talk to your Republican colleagues, do you get a sense that there is not a sense of urgency?
Oh, without question.
And
yeah.
Why do you think that is?
I don't know. I've heard a term.
What do they say when they challenge? What do they say to you when you challenge them?
Well, you know, we're going to get to it. We're working on it. I'm still, you know, it's still a, you know, still a priority. And you know, I mean, there's a point in time where, you know, there's different levels of language that and volume of language that I'm willing to use. I'm to the place now where okay, you know, we're in this three months, and the citizens of Flint are, you know, we're starting our fourth year. If we don't learn from this, and we've spent hundreds of millions of taxpayers' dollars to help try to solve a problem all across the state, taxpayers from all across the country, and if we don't make changes, then that is one of the most idiotic things I've ever heard of. So I'm going to keep pushing for it. You know, one, there's a term that it's really offensive, and I would encourage people that are listening to, if they hear their legislator in the House or Senate say it, a term called Flint fatigue. You know, when people say that to me, I say, well, think about what the fatigue is like when you haven't had fresh water for 3 years. You know, I'm sorry that you have to push a button and that's too much for you. Well, you shouldn't have put policies in place like the emergency manager law that took our democracy away and stripped us of our rights, and then wondered why, and now want to walk away from your mistakes. This was avoidable, 100% avoidable, and we can avoid it for the rest of the state, and we should.
And I know you're working on efforts, as you mentioned, to lower the lead action level, to make Flint a promise zone, create a water resources commission, reestablish the childhood lead commission. Are any of these gaining traction in the legislature?
Yeah, I think so. I'm going to keep pushing, and I'm not somebody who takes no very lightly. I've been able to be successful in Lansing because I just keep, you know, I'm like that little dog in the cartoon. I just keep nipping at their heels until we do it. And we're very fortunate. We have a very dynamic school leader in our community, superintendent. I think we're going to get some traction on the Flint Promise Zone, which I think will help stabilize our schools. It's not just the water. It's not just the residents. It's not just the children. It's not just the seniors. It's everything in Flint. It's our schools. It's our property taxes. And we need to stabilize. And I think one of the things that people get mixed up about Promise Zones is that we are capturing the growth on our own tax dollars. So we're saying we can raise the money. We want to make sure we have a vibrant school system. And if people play by the rules and graduate, they can have a portion or all of their school paid for. This is us coming together saying we can do this, and we have a great team working on it, and I think we're going to get that bill passed very shortly.
Your thoughts about the state's emergency manager law. In particular, I'm wondering, do you think this disaster stemmed from the law or from the people who were chosen to be Flint's emergency manager?
I think a little bit of both. I think when you write a law that basically strips people of all their voice, they have no say in their government. You know, the founding fathers, you know, we fought a revolution because of that. That idea was right then, it's still right now. There has to be voice, there has to be participation, and a part of it's also the people that came in. We were kind of given people that weren't that great, weren't very successful in their own right, and then also a bad law in the first place. And then there was also a number of folks at the state level in various departments that either had the information and didn't tell people, hid the information, or outright lied. So it was a failure from top to bottom, but the emergency manager law being repealed would go a long way, I think, to help him make sure this doesn't happen again.
You were a high school social studies teacher and then a Flint City Council member and a member of the State House on the State Senate. What lessons about public service and politics would you teach your high school students based on what you've learned from your years in politics during this really unusually dramatic period, even for Michigan in our history?
I'd probably be more of a cynical teacher now than I was when I started, because I try to teach about, you know, the principles and the things that we all learn in school. I probably would teach a lot more, because I'm a pretty direct, and you know, you've had me on before. I don't like to sugarcoat things.
No.
I would teach people about the way it really is, and I think that people would, you know, I think students would have their eyes opened up, and I think a lot of people in Michigan already do have their eyes open up, and I hope more see the failings we have in our state and federal government.
When you realize that what Mayor Weaver recommended takes Flint and his residents right back in this great big sad circle to where it all started, and you think that it was April 16th, 2013, almost 4 years exactly, when Emergency Manager Ed Kurtz signed that contract that switched the city from Detroit Water to the KWA, what are your feelings as you just think about the irony of all of this and everything that's happened to people in this city?
Yeah, it's really, a lot of decisions get made, you know, and I live here and Representative Neely lives here and others from here. And we try to share that. We try to channel the voice. I think that's sometimes why we're angry when we're talking about it, because we feel the anger when we're home, and we have it ourselves. A lot of decisions are being made for the people of Flint, not listening to what they want. And I think that's a continuation of the problems and the fears and the frustration people had. So this has been a pretty terrible experience for us. And a lot of us, residents and other folks, were raising our hands saying, there's something wrong here. And to basically go, you know, we're kind of going full circle. Sometimes people forget that the rates were extremely high, and Detroit had a sort of over the barrel, and I think a lot of folks were looking for answers. But to get us a long-term water source is good. Now we have to make sure that people can afford it.
That was State Senator Jim Ananick. Since our conversation last Saturday evening in Flint, the State Senate and House have voted to send $100 million in federal money to Flint. It'll help replace lead-damaged water pipes. That measure is now on its way to Governor Snyder for his signature. And tomorrow on Stateside, Senate Majority Leader Arlen Meekhoff will outline the Senate's plans for responding to Flint's water crisis. We reached out to House Speaker Tom Leonard's office, and they said he was in budget meetings and unable to join us. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Donald Trump was elected president by pledging to make America great again. Economist Marina von Neumann-Whitman thinks the proposed Trump budget would deeply harm the very things that make our country great, public goods. She's a professor at the Ford School of Public Policy at the University of Michigan, and she served on President Nixon's Council of Economic Advisors. It is always good to have you with us.
It really is a delight, Cynthia, to be here again.
So start by telling us, what is a public good?
Okay. If you ask an economist will say, well, it's non-excludable and non-rivalrous.
Okay, and everybody's brainwaves just went flat.
Exactly. Of course they did. And what that means, in plain English, is that anybody can consume it, and that the fact that one person or group of people use it does not reduce its availability to other people.
So give me examples of the kind of public goods that you feel really do make America great.
Well, there are really two kinds. One are the natural kind, you know, our wonderful lakes and oceans and air and so forth. And the others are the ones that are generally created by government. National parks, public education,
Libraries,
interstate highways,
post offices,
all of the above. Exactly. And even the ones that are natural do need government and appropriate regulation to protect them.
Now, in what ways, then, do you feel that President Trump's proposed budget would be bad for our public goods?
Well, if you look at the proposed budget, for one thing, his proposed budget, now who knows what it'll turn out like, cuts virtually all the money for cleaning up the Great Lakes, which certainly are a big public good. He cuts vehemently the funding for the EPA to minimize the damaging effects of climate change. And not to mention that the proposed budget zeroes out things like the National Endowment for the Arts, the National Endowment for the Humanities, all of the National Public Radio, by the way, all of these are public goods which are available to everybody and which we would sorely miss.
In this country, you point out in a really great piece you did for The Conversation, our country's had a really nice, long, bipartisan history of supporting public goods until you say about the 1960s. What changed?
That's right. Well, I mean, sure, you had a Republican setting up the National Park Service. You had the Democrat FDR, of course, creating all kinds of public buildings. You had Republican President Eisenhower establishing the interstate highway system. What happened?
What happened in the 60s?
What happened in the 60s? Several things. For one thing, bipartisanship, which is pretty much essential for the support of public goods, most of which, as I say, require taxpayers' money one way or another, started to erode. And by now, it's essentially non-existent.
So here we have the right that wants to cut taxes.
Right.
And progressives on the left want to expand entitlements.
And in between, the public goods are squeezed. So that's one big thing. Secondly, of course, there's always been at every level of government a shortage of money, so that a bunch of things that used to be purely public goods, from garbage collection right on to charter schools, have been partly or totally privatized. And the other thing is that there have been a number of studies done which unfortunately tell us that when a population becomes more heterogeneous, that is, there are more people that are not just like us, support for public goods erodes.
Now, that's interesting. So the more there are, quote, the others.
Exactly.
The less the support, because what, we don't want to share that with the others?
Exactly. Another word for that is racism.
Boy, so we've seen that building. And, mm-hmm. and yet you say things had been going well for public goods shared across borders, international public goods. What would those be?
Right. Oh, right after World War II, the United States took leadership in setting up a bunch of alliances with other countries and a whole group of international institutions to promote public goods around the world, the institutions being all the way from the United Nations to the World Bank to the International Monetary Fund and so forth. The biggest public good, of course, is peace, or at least the avoidance of global war. And by its leadership for, well, at least 70 years.
Since the end of World War II?
Since the end of World War II. The United States has led in what's sometimes called the Pax Americana, the American peace. And while we've got a lot of unpleasant hostilities in various parts of the world, we have not had global warfare. And as I say, probably the biggest, if not the most reliable, is the United Nations, which, of course, plays a role in adjudicating hostilities and also has a bunch of associated agencies which do all kinds of things. The law of the sea, for example, makes free navigation possible.
Relief efforts in
relief efforts,
countries.
Exactly.
Okay. And those are under threat now?
They certainly are. I mean, President Trump has called NATO obsolete.
Although now he's saying, well, I said it was obsolete, but
now
it's not.
Isn't. Yeah. Exactly. He has promoted cutting funds for international aid. He has talked about undercutting international institutions in various ways. He said, well, if we don't like the decisions made by the World Trade Organizations, we'll just pull out. And again, usually his bark is in the end worse than his bite, but even words have consequences.
So this unraveling and this pulling inward of America.
Exactly.
Make America first.
Exactly. And that has, it's almost as if he were trying to maximize the number of friends we lose or the number of enemies, not necessarily in the military sense.
Yes, yes.
We acquire.
And that, as you say, that Pax Americana has been a public good. So you have advised a Republican president when you were with Richard Nixon's Council of Economic Advisors. If you had the chance, how would you advise Mr. Trump?
I would tell him that you don't make America great by undercutting a lot of things that historically in the last century or most of it have indeed made America great. So that, you know, that's marching in the wrong direction. And then I would try to explain to him, if he would sit still for it, some of the reasons why that's true, which is some of the things we've been talking about.
What's at stake here?
A lot. I think certainly American leadership. In any case, it looks like America is, the United States, is not as alone in leadership as it was. There clearly is some contest going on between the United States and China, for example, for influence in Asia. The Russians, I think, less successfully are trying to exert their, quote, regional leadership.
Not for lack of effort.
Not for lack of effort, right. But the fact is, in any case, we're moving to a somewhat more multipolar world than existed in the half century or more after World War II. But the fact is that many of the things President Trump has suggested almost guarantees that that soft power is going to move in other directions. For example, the Trans-Pacific Trade Partnership, which we originated, which had a lot of the things that we wanted in it. And under President Obama, we persuaded a great many countries, mainly but not entirely in Asia, to sign it. Suddenly, he pulls out. And now the Chinese are busy trying to fill the gap with their version of a multi-regional trade pact. And I just don't see how that can be helpful to U.S. leadership.
Marina von Neumann-Whitman, economist, it's always wonderful talking with you. Thank you so much.
Cynthia, as always, I've enjoyed it. Thank you.
I, Gerald R. Ford, do grant.
The other passengers very reluctantly gave up their seats, but I refused.
The young man makes up his mind to work. There's no limit to what he can do.
This is truly the next chapter in General Motors' recovery and turnaround.
You're living at a time of extremism, a time of revolution.
80 years ago, our nation experienced its first wave of Batmania. And no, it was not caused by the comic book hero. Bruce Wayne was still a few years away from being created. Rather, the country's imagination was captured by winged daredevils like Michigander Clem Sohn. Daredevils who would jump out of planes wearing a flying suit, and the plan was to glide back down to Earth and pull that parachute cord at the last possible moment to impress crowds at air shows. So here now to talk about our state's history, as we do every Wednesday, Mark Harvey and Rachel Clark, our partners at the Michigan History Center. So let's start at the very beginning. Michigan's birdman, Clem Sohn. Where in Michigan is he from?
He's from Fowler, Michigan, which is just north of Lansing, small farming community. Beautiful place, just not where you would expect the flying Batman to come from. So he wound up coming into Lansing and graduated from Lansing Eastern High School.
And what time are we talking about?
In the late 1920s, he graduated from Lansing School.
All right. Just about the time that airplanes were becoming, you know, something that people accepted and got, but still it was thrilling to see airplanes. Do we know how Clem Sohn got involved in this new technology of aircraft to become an aerial daredevil?
From what we've read, he crossed paths with the local aviator Art Davis, who did lots of interesting things. In fact, we have a photo collection where he has some promotional shots of a dog in a biplane with goggles on top of his head. So he was early aviation pioneer. This is right along the time when Capital City Airport opened up in Lansing. And we're getting close to the time when Lindbergh has finished his flight and he has Michigan roots. So this is a big deal, especially in Michigan. And so he crossed paths with Art Davis and gets involved in aviation.
And these aviation daredevil shows, I remember the movie The Great Waldo Pepper. So, I mean, they were happening all across the country where people would come out. And what would happen at these daredevil shows?
A lot of times what would happen is you would have a jumper who would come out of planes and parachute, or you would have aeronautics of a plane. So as time went on, you see more people who, like Clem Sohn, who are jumping out of planes, parachuting, doing free falls and things of that nature.
I know I've seen pictures of the wing walkers, and you think I could never in a million years do that. Plus, as you say, all the circles and the loop-de-loops and things that the pilots would do. So it is something. If you look at Clem's flying suit, it truly looks like something out of a Jules Verne novel. Basically, two large wings that spread out when he raises his arms and connected cloth between his pant legs. And it almost seems like he took a look at a bird and said, well, you know, if it works for that bird, it ought to work for me. What do we know about how and when he designed his suit?
The suit that he originally designed was about 4 feet wide, 4 or 5 feet wide, and about 2 feet tall. And it is steel tubing with heavy canvas wrapped around it. So you have a steel tubing sort of skeleton with canvas wrapped around it. So that's one part of his suit. And then the other part is a pair of twill or canvas pants with a piece of material between his legs to act the same as a bird tail. Between the two things, he could steer, he could float for a while, and those were the things that he used to entertain audiences.
Built for strength, not for lightness. Like, it's not like a bird's bones are hollow and light. Clem's suit was heavy and strong.
Yes.
I just think about the first tests, like what it took to say, okay, let's see if this works. I mean,
all right. Here we go.
There was no, you know, you couldn't get on and do any computer-aided design back then to kind of have all the numbers tell you, yes, this should work or yes,
yeah,
this
I wonder
shouldn't.
If he got up on his garage and jumped off like not kids sure. do with umbrellas. Probably,
I know he would throw flower bags out of the plane to see for drop speed and where the flower would land. I don't know what that told him, but I did read about him throwing sacks of flour out of the plane.
So how high would they be? And he would jump, and then at some point he'd have to pull his parachute. So
for the shows that he did, they would fly about 10,000 feet in and around, and then he would jump at 10,000 feet. He had two parachutes. He had his main chute and then his secondary chute. And he, depending on, you know, conditions and all that, he would wait until he was about 1,000 feet or less from the ground before he would pull his chute.
We're all cringing
here. Shaking my head.
And he debuted this suit in 1935. How fast did it become a national sensation?
It became a national sensation pretty quickly. After he successfully did a jump, I think it was in Daytona, you have people who are attempting to copy him. There was actually an unfortunate incident of a young man from Flint who attempted to copy Clem's jump about a month later, and his chute got caught in his wings, and he ended up killed at Bishop Airport. But you do have other people who are jumping and successful. But Clem held a world record for the longest dive before he pulled his chute. It was 18,500 feet.
And they would compete, right?
Yes,
you're
they
saying,
would.
Yeah.
It would be float time as well as distance before you pull your chute.
And was this also becoming a thing in Europe?
It was. He actually ended up performing in England, and then his final performance was actually in Paris or outside Paris.
Now that you mention his final performance, one might suspect, not a big reach to think, maybe this Clem sound story did not end happily. So what became of Clem and his final jump?
As his popularity increased and then he had that world record, he was invited to France to perform. He and Art Davis were taking a ship over, and actually the story is they were delayed by weather. And so by the time they got there, Clem did not have a chance to check his chutes. And the theory is that the chutes got very damp. And so he jumped. He appeared to be doing all right for a while. And then when it came time to pull his chute, neither his primary nor secondary chute deployed, or they didn't fill. And so he ended up falling in front of about 1,000 spectators.
Okay. And I know there's actually an old British newsreel
footage of that,
which I watched. You have to think, would these competitions even be allowed today? Because it kind of seems like an aerial version of Russian roulette.
There are actually a couple international competitions. Red Bull sponsors one. They are wingsuit competitions. They're called a bunch of different things. But essentially, it's the same design as Clemson's original suit. It's just better materials. And they have various competitions for, again, speed and distance and aeronautics. And
Clem died this week in France 80 years ago. But we have to stop and think that, you know, Batman was not around at the time. You wonder how much inspiration. And then when we think of cartoons we grew up with.
Yes. In looking at photos of Clemson in his suit, I'm reminded of Wile E. Coyote's Acme bat suit that he purchases. And it's actually a successful suit for him. It's one of the few items from Acme that he gets that actually works for him. He just
Rachel and
use
I
it
had
well.
A great historical conversation about the linkages between Clemson and Wile E. Coyote. Mm-hmm.
And so there's certainly no reason that the animators would not have been inspired by what they saw of Clem.
They would have been youngsters at the time of Clem's jumps.
Well, Clemson, you've given us something to talk about again. 80 years ago this week, Clemson made his final jump, and that was over France. Michigan History Center's Rachel Clark and Mark Harvey, thank you so much for sharing this piece of Michigan's history with us.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty.
Experimentation.
Curiosity.
The next idea.
Technology alone is not enough.
Many online companies are readying for a showdown with the Trump administration and the big internet providers over net neutrality. The rules enacted during the Obama administration basically prevent broadband providers from playing favorites with speed and connectivity and from steering users toward or away from particular internet sites. Yesterday, the chairman of the FCC officially unveiled plans to loosen those rules. Jeff DeGraff of The Next Idea says, forget net neutrality. Regulatory neutrality is what we really need.
In the early 1990s, I visited billionaire George Soros' office in New York City.
It was to provide some direction on an investment his firm had made in a technology startup run by senior Israeli Air Force officers. Their technology was something akin to an iPod, and this was almost a decade before you could store your entire music collection on a device the size of a bar of soap. The officers had the prescient concern that the internet was not designed to be secure and that this vulnerability would eventually lead to cybercrime and espionage. They believed there would come a time when we would customize the part of the web we needed and keep it secure in our own pocket. These brilliant innovators had a solution, except it was 25 years before we knew there was a problem. Well, as they say on Broadway, everything old is new again. Recently, the Federal Communications Commission decided to eliminate most of the net neutrality regulations that required broadband providers to inform customers about how they manage their networks. The commission is now led by Ajit Pai, a former legal counsel for Verizon. Apparently, this appointment isn't seen as a conflict of interest. The upside of this decision is that it may provide economic incentives for investing in innovations that improve network connectivity and speed. The downside is that it will cede control of who has access to the net and at what price to the largest broadband carriers. While government officials and public advocacy groups are waging a war of words in the media, little attention is being paid to the opportunity this creates for more disruptive technology companies like that little Israeli startup from the 1990s. In President Trump's first address to the joint session of Congress, he repeated his campaign pledge to spend $1 trillion revitalizing the nation's infrastructure. But infrastructure is more than just roads, bridges, and airports. It's also digital. Over the past 50 years, taxpayers have invested billions in the development of the internet. That makes us majority shareholders. Why should the rights of telecom shareholders be represented with these changes to net neutrality and not ours? It's hard to imagine anyone investing in a company without some form of control or transparency, but that's exactly what our government is now demanding that we do. The convergence of delivery options such as cable internet, DSL, 4G wireless, and satellite drives today's competition. Add to this mix upstarts with radical new technologies, low-cost providers from other regions, and fluid pay-as-you-go business models, and the market looks very different than today's oligarchy of sluggish behemoths. But is the net really being deregulated? Are the barriers of entry really being lowered to encourage true free market competition? Or are these simply different rules to protect the interests of a few incumbents? Look at who receives the best government contracts. They're not the most innovative companies. Instead, they're the largest. The fix is in. If you've visited Delhi or Seoul lately, you probably noticed how much better their service is than here at home. These cities see their investment in digital infrastructure as an engine of economic growth. The number of high-tech startups growing to over $1 billion is also following this trend. They are now creating a larger number of tech jobs faster than we are in the U.S. Given that we can't even get sufficient funding for passable roads and drinkable water, what hope is there that our government will adequately support the development of a superior digital domain? The irony is that smaller organizations are far more likely to introduce breakthrough innovations than their larger rivals because they lack the resources to compete on scope or scale. Ingenuity is all they have. They are the seedlings that grow into larger job-producing companies. When the next breakthrough communication technology emerges, we can only hope that people like George Soros allow us to invest in it. That way, we have a reasonable chance of being treated like shareholders and getting some real return on our investment.
Support for the next idea on Stateside comes from Michigan Economic Development Corporation, committed to marketing Michigan to drive job growth and investment in our communities. MichiganBusiness.org.
It's a double dose of good news for Fiat Chrysler. Detroit News business columnist Daniel Howes is here to break things down for us. And first quarter profits coming in, FCA net profits up 34% over year-ago levels. Daniel, was this expected?
Judging by the reaction of investors, I would say not so much. Sergio Marchionne, the CEO, has been doing some interesting things there. I mean, he's killed car production in the United States, definitely doubling down on Jeep SUV production, pickup production in the United States. And he's gutted through the loss of those cars from the lineup, but he's continuing to make money. The other thing that I think is very interesting is we've been hearing for years, I mean, literally years, I could say going back almost 15 years, that Alfa Romeo was coming to the United States. It's finally coming to the United States. The vehicles are launching here. They're in dealerships, getting great reviews. And I think you're going to start to see more contribution from the luxury brands of the Fiat Chrysler group, which will help overall the company's performance.
I know news this morning from Dearborn was not quite as rosy, with Ford profits down 35% over the first quarter, although the company still says it's on track to make $9 billion in pre-tax profit.
Yeah, I think a lot of this has to be put in perspective. You know, it was 8 years ago when this industry was at death's door, and now people, if they're going to make $9 billion on the year instead of $10 billion, it's somehow things are going pear-shaped. Clearly they're not. I think we're in a market here that's defying gravity. As of last year, I think we were in about our seventh year of expansion. The last time we had that was in the 1960s, meaning every year we're selling more cars and trucks in the United States than the year before. Now we're reaching a plateau, but we're plateauing at a very high level. And I think with some of the proposals coming out of Washington just this week, the Trump administration threw out a tax proposal that is being derided by some, but I think is being seen by others as at least talking points with Congress. That probably will have a salutary effect on the auto business if it has a salutary effect on consumers.
Talking about the proposed tax reform, certainly the Detroit-based automakers feeling pretty good about this. But shouldn't we point out that one page the White House released saying corporate taxes would drop from 35 to 15%? Aren't companies already getting their taxes way down to the 18 to 20% range anyway through exemptions and write-offs?
In part, I think they are, but more globally, I mean, you've got several trillion dollars in U.S. profits that are parked overseas. I think one of the things they're trying to do is get some of that money and get it repatriated and tax it as it comes back, so the Treasury would get some of that, and that would be one way to offset the cost of a tax cut. The fact of the matter is the American corporate rate is one of the highest in the world. I mean, when I was in Germany 15 years ago, you know, they had one of the highest corporate rates. It was close to 40%. Now it's closer to 15%. Britain has cut its corporate tax rate. Ireland has cut its corporate tax rate. Why do you think American corporations do these so-called inversions and move their headquarters to the UK or to Ireland? This is one of the primary reasons. When you're talking about profits in the billions of dollars, you know, those percentages make a real difference in terms of how much money the companies can make, how much they can return to shareholders in the form of dividends, and all sorts of other markers. So one of the goals here is to get corporate America to be a little bit more planted in the United States than it otherwise has been, and not give it an excuse to leave. And it's been used as an excuse to leave. I'm not saying that's always the reason, but it certainly has been one of the reasons.
You note in your column today, Detroit automakers are still trying to prove they're different than, let's see how you put it, the sad sack heap that begged Congress and two successive administrations for bailouts. Do you think the message is hitting home in Trump-era Washington?
That they're different?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, I think in some ways they are, but I don't think that's really the audience. The audience is the investment community. We've talked many times on your show about Detroit versus Silicon Valley. That is really where the battle for the industry is in terms of proving that they're different. The investment community looks at Detroit and says, you know, 8 years ago you were at death's door. The taxpayers had to bail you out. You're riding high now. What's to say you can manage another downturn? And oh, by the way, you're trying to out-tech the tech capital of the world. So I think the real audience is not Trump, Washington. It's Silicon Valley and Wall Street investors who are saying, you know, I don't think you're a good investment. It's ironic that the most valued, depending on when you look at it, American automaker is Tesla, which has not made a profit, continues to make promises it doesn't often keep. But on the other hand, you've got automakers in the United States like GM and Ford, for example, that are delivering and are hitting their numbers and are launching product on time and making a lot of money. In fact, more than they've ever made in our lifetimes, probably.
Detroit News business columnist Daniel Howes. Thanks, Daniel.
Thank you.
More than 100 women and girls claim they were sexually assaulted by former MSU and USA Gymnastics doctor Larry Nassar. Complaints against the former MSU sports doctor range from the late 1990s up to 2016. He's now in federal custody on child pornography charges and 25 counts of first-degree criminal sexual conduct involving 10 women. He continues to deny the accusations. An investigation based on hundreds of pages of emails and records from Michigan State, published this week by the Washington Post, finds NASA left warning signs that were missed or ignored by Michigan State officials. Will Hobson is the Washington Post national sports reporter. Welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
Will, you reviewed hundreds of emails and documents that you got using a Freedom of Information Act from Michigan State University. Many were heavily redacted. And so just to be clear, this is not a complete picture. Saying that, what is it you found?
We found that while nationally a lot of the blame for Dr. Nassar and the abuse he's occurred of has been laid at the feet of the folks at USA Gymnastics, the Olympic officials, there's more evidence that suggests that folks at Michigan State had a chance to stop him earlier.
MSU President Luana Simon told the Board of Trustees this month they're trying to figure out, in her words, how something so abhorrent happened here and went on for so long. And you discovered some clues that could help answer her question. Your article points out MSU officials missed a number of opportunities to have stopped Dr. Nassar. Let's start with William Strampel, who's the dean of MSU's College of Osteopathic Medicine and his supervisor. According to your piece, Dean Strampel seemed to fail to grasp the seriousness of the situation. What made you conclude that?
There's an email from a colleague of Dean Strampel's in which one of the doctors who works alongside Dr. Nassar was asking in 2016, last September, how long Dr. Nassar was going to be out. And according to this was a secondhand email, but Dean Strampel told this colleague that he only expected to be a short period of time. And I think it's important to point out that, you know, we're still midstream here. There's still a lot of things we don't know. And the records we looked at are still heavily redacted because it's an active criminal investigation. And any reference to a 2014 complaint similar to the one that ended up getting Dr. Nassar fired and ultimately arrested last year, anything related to that has been redacted in these records.
But you were certainly able to put together a lot of information from the emails that you were able to see that were not redacted. I noted at one point Dean Strampel sent an email to Nassar, "Good luck, I'm on your side."
Right. And, you know, we weren't able to talk to Dean Strampel about this. But the emails from Dean Strampel in 2016, and just for your listeners, Dean Strampel would be Larry Nassar's boss at the College of Osteopathic Medicine at Michigan State. In 2016, he would have been aware that 2 years prior, a woman came forward and said, "This doctor sexually assaulted me during an exam." So it was interesting to see how the dean responded when another person came forward in 2016 with a very similar complaint about Dr. Nassar.
Well, you also wrote in your article that the university's public relations staff coached Dr. Nassar in how to handle a reporter's questions about his history of abuse. What did you find there?
Early September of last year, a reporter with the Indianapolis Star reached out to Dr. Nassar with a series of questions. And his boss asked for advice from Michigan State Legal Counsel and the public relations department about how he should deal with this. The legal counsel, interestingly, said, "We have no advice for you. You're on your own on this one." The PR staff just gave him advice, said you can ignore these questions entirely. If you're going to answer, answer in writing and be sure to not blame the victims in any way.
I want to back up a little bit, kind of open up to the big picture, Will. Did you find in all of those hundreds of documents and emails that you looked through that anyone within the MSU hierarchy who suggested that the women's complaints should be looked at more closely?
No, but again, as I said, we're looking at an incomplete piece, and that's why it's going to be interesting to follow this case and to follow what happens at Michigan State, how the folks in charge were able to see all these records, were able to interview all these people and ask them, what did you know and when did you know it, to see how they respond. An equivalent example would be look at what happened with Penn State during the Jerry Sandusky scandal just 5 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
They brought in independent investigators who were able to interview everybody, and they came to, you know, university conclusions about who was responsible and who knew what when. So it'll be interesting to see what Michigan State says and what their independent reviews find in the months as the case continues to progress.
Something that struck me in your piece, Will, was when you reviewed the emails and what you learned about the communication between Michigan State University and USA Gymnastics, both key components of this entire story, but it sure seemed that they weren't talking to each other, were they?
Right. That has been really frustrating to the victims here, to the, again, alleged victims here, because Dr. Nassar still is pleading his innocence and hasn't been convicted yet. But in 2014, Michigan State investigated an allegation of assault against a doctor and found no wrongdoing, but they didn't let the folks at USA Gymnastics know about this. Now, in 2015, USA Gymnastics over in Indianapolis, they had a separate investigation, very similar complaint of assault. They cut ties with the doctor. They concluded that something bad had happened there. The USA Gymnastics folks say that they were told by the FBI not to inform anybody else. The FBI has yet to confirm that, and we'll see if they ever do. But the end result of that is that from late 2015 until 2016, Dr. Nasser continued to treat children. We think he continued to abuse children, and there are a number of cases that could have been prevented.
And it isn't exactly as if it was a secret to USA Gymnastics that he was affiliated with MSU because they funded his volunteer work with USA Gymnastics.
Right. And I should correct what I said there. We don't think he continued to abuse children. The plaintiff's lawyers contend he abused children, and victims contend he abused children. The tricky thing about this case from a journalism perspective is that while there are an overwhelming number of allegations of abuse, Dr. Nasser still is an innocent man who maintains that this is all a misunderstanding over his medical treatment, and he'll have his day in court.
Will, you covered the Jerry Sandusky scandal at Penn State. You alluded to it a moment or two ago. Are there any parallels that you are seeing here with the way MSU has handled the Dr. Nasser situation?
Well, it's interesting. A lot of the online readership and activity on our stories about Dr. Nasser from a national perspective are from Penn State folks who are upset with Luana Simon, the president of Michigan State, because she was involved with the NCAA's punishments of Penn State in the aftermath of that case. They find it interesting that Luana Simon, she made a comment to the Board of Trustees recently that she'd been told that something to the effect that she'd been told that some sexual pedophiles and predators are virtually impossible to stop, which is startlingly different rhetoric than she used with regard to the Jerry Sandusky case.
What new questions has all of the digging you've done so far, what new questions has that raised in your mind?
I mean, I don't know if there are any new questions. I'm sure folks in Michigan are well aware of this. It's just a matter of, like any investigation, determining who in charge of Dr. Nasser, who worked with Dr. Nasser, knew what and when. And we don't have conclusive answers yet, and it'll be a while until we do. But I think the point of our story from a national perspective was just, you know, here in D.C. and nationally, USA Gymnastics, the Olympic organization, has taken a lot of the blame for Dr. Nasser and the abuse he's accused of. But there are far more public signs so far, at least, that folks at Michigan State could have prevented it before folks at USA Gymnastics would have known.
Will Hobson, national sports reporter for The Washington Post. Thank you so much for speaking with us.
No problem. Thanks for having me.
That's our show for today. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so very much for listening.